The following is a North Carolina Baptist resource. For more, visit ncbaptist.org.
We're going to talk about sexuality, and I thought I'd tell you kind of a story to kind of lighten the mood up front, since we're going to be talking about these things. Several years ago, I was flipping pancakes on a Saturday morning for my daughters, and at the time, we were living in the southern part of Colorado Springs. I had a neighbor, and they had a little boy named Jonah, and he was, I think, about 6 years old, and my two oldest daughters were 5 and 7 around this time, so he had a crush on at least two of them, and he would come over to our house every single day and knock on the door and want to play. So we loved Jonah. He was a neat kid, and anyway, one morning, I'm flipping pancakes, and got my back to my daughters, and they're just talking, and my middle daughter just talks all the time. She just never stops talking, and she piped up, "Hey, Daddy, Jonah's ding-a-ling is broken." Yeah, that's what I did. The pancake froze in midair. And I was like, what? And I turned around and said, "What did you say?" He said, "Jonah's ding-a-ling is broken." And I'm starting to panic, like, what's going on? And my older daughter goes, "Yeah, his ding-a-ling, it's broken." And I'm thinking, what on earth is happening to my innocent daughters? Like, I'm going to have to go beat up a six-year-old. Like, what is happening? So I turned around and I said, "Could you please, I don't think I understood you. Could you say it in a different way?" And Anna goes, "On his bike, his bell, it doesn't work anymore." Oh, so that was my first experience with heart failure. And anyway, we're going to talk about sexuality, and we're going to talk about it in a couple different ways. A lot of this stuff, by the way, I'm going to pull out of one particular chapter in the book, A Practical Guide to Culture. In A Practical Guide to Culture, we talk about culture, and we use the motif or the metaphor of water. There's an old Chinese proverb that says, if you want to know what water is, don't ask the fish. Right? Well, why wouldn't you ask the fish about water? I asked a group of high schoolers that once. They're like, "I don't know, because fish can't talk." No, it's because fish don't know anything other than water. Does that make sense? And this is a very important insight, because when we talk about, and the title of the session is The New Sexual Orthodoxy, we're talking about the new sexual water. In other words, the new sexual culture. We're not just talking about specific challenges of the L, the G, the B, the T, or porn, or, you know, adultery, or these issues. We're talking about a new cultural reality that has changed about sexuality. When we talk about water, in the book, A Practical Guide to Culture, we go through a whole bunch of issues, but there are two different types of issues. If you've ever been at the beach and you got hit by a wave that you weren't expecting, you know it, you felt it. And a lot of us feel like that when it comes to culture right now, don't we? I mean, there's things that have hit us out of nowhere. We're like, seriously? The cover of Time magazine has a cover story about a man giving birth? Right? I mean, I remember seeing that headline when I was in junior high in the grocery store checkout line with that world newspaper. You know, remember that thing? The tabloid paper? But this is Time magazine that ran that as a headline 2 years ago. Some of us feel like some of these issues have hit us like waves. And in the book, we talk about those specific waves like pornography and like the same-sex marriage and the gender identity issue. But let me ask you this. Have you ever been at the beach with your kid and, you know, they're in the water and you're sitting in your beach chair and you look down for just maybe a minute or two and you look up and they're not there and you panic? But then you just look down the beach and they're there, but they've just been kind of drifted down the beach. Has that ever happened to anybody? It wasn't a wave. No one felt it. But how did they get down there? It was an undercurrent. And you know what? Just like that happens at the beach, just like that happens, there are waves and there are undercurrents when it comes to culture. In fact, let me just say this. Culture is most powerful in our lives, not where it's the loudest or the noisiest, but where it makes things seem the most normal. And what I want to talk about is the undercurrent. Let me give you an example of the truthfulness of that statement, that culture is most powerful, not where it's the loudest, but where it makes things seem the most normal. Oh yeah, Warren, thanks, you reminded me of something. I have a slide presentation for this as well, okay? We just had technical problems. And so if you guys would want a copy of that, Warren's going to pass around these clipboards. Just put your name and email address. Please write it legibly, you pastors that wanted to be lawyers. And please write it legibly so we can do that. If you've signed it once, you don't need to sign it more than once, okay? So if you signed it after the session, you don't need to. But if you want the presentation, we'll send it to you. Okay, let me give you an example. The MTV Video Music Awards. is the award show that tries to outdo itself, right? It is the edgy one. It's been known that way since Madonna rolled around in a wedding dress singing Like a Virgin back in the 1990s. And then a few years later, Madonna and Britney Spears shared the stage and they shared a lesbian kiss. It was the first lesbian kiss on television. And then a few years later, Nicki Minaj had some sort of creepy demonic exorcism. And then Miley Cyrus got a chance. What could possibly go wrong? Miley Cyrus performed a song with a guy named Robin Thicke that was popular that year and basically simulated having sex on stage. It was the talk of the culture for about 3 weeks. It made a big splash. It created a lot of noise. I was asked about it on several interviews. Everyone was really talking about it. But by and large, even though it was really noisy, people didn't like it. People thought it crossed the line. In fact, even Joan Rivers, who was never known as the conscience of America, said that it crossed the line. Well, fast forward just about 3 or 4 months to the Grammys. The Grammys took place in California. In California earlier that year, a judge, this is before the Obergefell decision that had mandated same-sex marriage on America. So this is after Prop 8, which was a vote of the people of California to define marriages between a man and a woman. An activist judge had overturned that vote as unconstitutional, basically allowing same-sex marriage in California. The Grammys happened just a little bit after that. Okay, so you get the timeline. One of the most popular songs of that year was called Same Love by Macklemore, which is about heterosexual love and homosexual love being the same love. And so he performed it at the Grammys. And as he performed it, Queen Latifah, who had been ordained on the internet, presided over a mass wedding where 70 or some different couples got married. Some of them were heterosexual couples, some of them were homosexual couples, and she literally married them there on the stage of the Grammys. So what we basically had was the first gay wedding televised on national television. And that's what happened. Well, I was asked about it later on. I do a weekly podcast with World Magazine called The World and Everything in It. I also do a podcast of our own called Breakpoint. But on the World podcast, my host, Nick, asked me offline. He goes, you know, it's interesting. I started to, try to find good quotes and stuff for this story, and no one's really talking about it. I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, you know, Al Mohler talked about it and you guys talked about it. But I looked around and the secular media, they didn't even really blink at this one. Now, here's my question. Which one of those two events, the MTV Video Music Awards or the Grammy Awards event, which one tells you more about where our culture is? Is it the one that was so loud and noisy that everyone kind of was like, Or was it the one that came and went like it was expected and no one blinked an eye because it just seemed normal? Do you see what I mean? And that's what I want to look at, because when we talk about the new sexual orthodoxy, we could hit, porn, and we could hit L, G, B, T, Q, I, A, and just go down the line. We could hit all of these individual issues, but there's something much deeper that has taken place. And that's what I want to talk about, is where basically what the sexual revolution has wrought. Here's another way to think about it. There has not been a more successful, sweeping social revolution in our lifetime than the sexual revolution. And I'm talking about many of us lived through some of you lived through the political ideologies of the late 20th century. They weren't as successful as the sexual revolution has been, because it has been sweeping. It has, if you look at culture as like, the seven spheres or the eight mountains or however people do it, the sexual revolution has dominated almost all of them. There's very few mountains left or spheres of culture left that the sexual revolution hasn't dominated from top to bottom. And I want to try to bring some understanding of that, because I don't think we can effectively minister to those who are struggling with sexual sin, to those who are having questions, to those who are parenting, especially those who are struggling. That's really where it gets hard, isn't it? When you deal with a parent that has been clear on what they believe their whole life, but now it's their own kid. That becomes really hard. So to really understand this, we need to understand the water. We need to understand the cultural environment in which these issues are taking place. I want to point you to an article. Okay, I'm going to give you some homework here. Okay, I want to point you to an article that begins our discussion with a very important observation. When you Google for this article, please Google carefully. Maybe Google with your wife in the room. Okay, here's the title of the article. It's called Sex After Christianity. The author is a blogger named Rod Dreher, D-R-E-H-E-R, Rod Dreher. And again, the article is called Sex After Christianity. He begins by giving us an insight that we need to think about. If you are tempted to look at all of the different sexual issues that we deal with in America right now, and you look at them and think, man, how much things have changed morally, and you think that the story of the sexual revolution is a moral shift, you're misunderstanding it. Let me say it again. If you think that really what's happened over the last several decades is that behaviors and activities that were once considered right are now considered wrong, and those that were once considered wrong are now considered okay, that that's the story, that it's a moral story that we're looking at, then you're misunderstanding it. Now, I'm not saying there hasn't been a moral slide. Of course there's been a moral slide. No one can question that behaviors that the church has always seen as sinful is now up for grabs in some, you know, segments of the church, including some of our brothers and sisters right now at the United Methodist Church dealing with it like today. We need to pray for them. There clearly has been some real moral shifts. I'm just suggesting that that's the effect, not the cause. That the moral changes are the fruit, not the root. That more fundamental to the moral shift that's taken place is what Rod Dreher calls a cosmological shift. In other words, the sexual revolution hasn't just changed our cultural minds on morality. The sexual revolution has changed our minds culturally on cosmology, the nature of reality itself. And specifically, it's changed our minds on anthropology. Now, I just gave through a whole bunch of polysyllabic words. Some of you are like, it's too early for that many syllables. Follow me, okay? It has not just changed our minds on morality. It's changed our minds on cosmology. That's not cosmetology. Cosmology is the nature of reality itself, the sort of world that we live in. If you go from one religion to another religion, one worldview to another worldview, we don't disagree on the specifics. We disagree on the nature of the world itself. That's what the sexual revolution has done to us. And secondly, it's changed our minds on anthropology, what it means to be human. Let me give you an illustration. I know there's very little evidence of it at this point in my life, but at one time I was an athlete, and I played wasn't that funny? I played basketball in high school and college, so I love the game of basketball. I'm a junkie. It's almost March, the most wonderful time of the year. And a couple years ago, it was actually more like 6 or 7 years ago, there was a story out of the NBA. Do you remember? A guy named Jason Collins wrote an article in Sports Illustrated, and the headline of the article was, "I'm black, I'm gay, and I'm in the NBA." Do you remember this article? It made national and international news. And the reason is although there had been many professional athletes that had come out as gay or lesbian, they had either been in women's sports, they had been in individual sports. Jason Collins was the first athlete still active in one of the big male sports to announce that he was gay. And so the question was, look, is the NBA ready for this? You know, is the NFL ready for this? And so that was the question that it created. And now, look, I've been around enough locker rooms to know that that was a risky announcement on his part, at least as far as his career goes. But if he was expecting negative backlash, what he got instead was a whole lot of support. The answer was culture was ready for this. And because, I mean, you know, you had NBA legends that were supporting him. You had Michelle Obama tweeted her support for him. President Obama picked up the phone and called and congratulated him on making his announcement. And here's what you hear when someone makes an announcement like this, and we certainly heard it when he made this announcement, is finally, fill in the blank, he can just what? Be himself. He no longer has to hide who he is. All right? Now, I was on the road somewhere speaking when that announcement came out, so I went back and went to my hotel room, turned on the TV. I wanted to see what they were saying on ESPN, and there was a show on called Outside the Lines, which deals with controversial sports issues, and the NBA commentator is one of my favorite. A guy named Chris Broussard was the guest commentator on this particular program. And they were asking Chris about the NBA. Like, is this going to change locker room life? Does this mean Jason Collins won't get picked up and signed by another team? Does this mean, you know, that more players are going to feel like they can come out? Is this going to change the league? You know, things like that. Legitimate sports questions. But then in the middle of the interview, they asked Chris Broussard a different sort of question. Because in that article, I'm Black, I'm Gay, and I'm in the NBA, Jason Collins not only said that he was a gay man, but he said he was a Christian, and that his understanding of Christianity was that God loved everyone, that Jesus was tolerant and accepting of all people, and so therefore he saw no problem between his chosen lifestyle and his faith. Chris Broussard, the NBA analyst that was on this show, is known to be a Christian. He's a courageous Christian. And so they asked him, "Hey, Chris, you're a Christian too. What do you think about this announcement? Not only that he's gay, but that he's a Christian. Can you be a gay Christian, Chris?" on national television. And all God's people said, "Awkward." Yeah, exactly. How do you answer a question like that? Well, Chris Broussard said, "Well, as a Christian, I think God created sex to be in the context of marriage between a man and a woman, and anything outside of that, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual, would be a sin." How do you think that went over? They called for him to be fired. They called for him to resign. They called for him to apologize. They called for him to be executed at dawn. They were really angry. They accused him of being a hater, of hating Jason Collins. Which is interesting, because if you look at his quote, I'm pretty sure he condemned the sexual behavior of the entire NBA with that quote, actually. But when Chris Broussard said that, the cultural response was, "You can't say that out loud. You have to keep that view to yourself." And they said, "What's this got to do with the cosmological shift and sex after Christianity?" Here's what it has to do with it. Because Western civilization has shifted dramatically because of the sexual revolution. Prior to the sexual revolution, Western civ has been made up of all kinds of ideological influences, from Christianity to the Greco-Roman influence to the secular Enlightenment influence. There wasn't a universal agreement on cosmology or anthropology, but there was an agreement that the sort of creatures we are were the sort of creatures who ask these big metaphysical questions, and our behavior is on the side. Now, what do you say? What do you mean by metaphysical questions? All these religious and ideological influences into Western civ would suggest that the sort of creatures that humans are the ones who ask questions like, is there a God, and is there truth, and how do we know, and what's right and wrong? The philosophical big questions. And our behavior is on the side. Right? Especially our sexual behavior. We behave based on how we see the world. Does that make sense? It doesn't mean that we all answer the questions the same way or that we all behave the same way, because we didn't. But what it meant to be human was to ask these big metaphysical questions with our behavior on the side. But look at this story of Jason Collins and Chris Broussard. Jason Collins makes an announcement about his sexual behavior, and he's told that's who he is. Chris Broussard makes a metaphysical observation about right and wrong, and he's told he has to keep that too. Do you see the swap? That's the shift. Let me put it a different way. If you work with students, for example, from the moment that they're born, they are told from nearly every single side of culture that the single most important thing about who they are, the defining characteristic of their identity, is their sexuality. It's not a part of their life. It's not a behavior. That their inclinations and urges is who they are. That's the new anthropological assumption. That's the cosmological shift. That's the undercurrent that's changed. In fact, the title of our chapter on this in the book, and I borrow from Rod, he calls his article Sex After Christianity. We call our chapter, and I give him credit, Identity After Christianity, because sex after Christianity is a brand new way of seeing what it means to be human. Now, where did this come from? Where did this new cosmological shift come from? It came from the sexual revolution. And the sexual revolution is something we often throw rocks at, but we rarely define. So let me define the sexual revolution for you very carefully. I want to give you the three fundamental beliefs of the sexual revolution. We have a phrase around the Colson Center that we borrowed from a guy named Richard Weaver. Some of you know that book. Ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. Because ideas have consequences, and basically what Weaver's trying to say with that is that ideas aren't just these esoteric concepts on a page. They walk out of the page and they walk into the real world. You might say that ideas have hands and feet, or ideas change the world, or ideas matter, or ideas are not dead, they're alive. Let me give you the second part of the equation that we often say at the Colson Center. And I want you to have these two things in mind as we walk through the sexual revolution. Ideas have consequences. Bad ideas have victims. Ideas have consequences. Bad ideas have victims. So I'm going to walk through the three ideas of the sexual revolution, and then I'm going to try to kind of talk about how they really were deeply embedded in our cultural moment, and then also who were the victims. I'll give you a hint. The victims of the sexual revolution have always been children. Children are always the victims of the bad ideas of the sexual revolution. Here's the first. The first big idea of the sexual revolution. Three big ideas. Here's the first one. Ready? Sex, marriage, and babies are separable. Sex, marriage, and babies are separable. Now, this is one that's really hard to explain because we live in a cultural moment where sex, marriage, and babies have been separated. Like, we're essentially, it's kind of a hard thing to even suggest to young people today that sex, marriage, and babies are a package deal. But you need to understand, throughout the entire history of the world until yesterday, historically speaking, sex, marriage, and babies were a package deal. They were seen as coming together. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is just a basic syllogism, a basic set of realities about the world. And I owe this to my friend Maggie Gallagher, but three things that are true whenever people get together. Ready? Number one, sex makes babies. Number two, society needs babies. If society doesn't have babies, society what? Dies. Number three, babies need a mom and a dad. Right? Now, that hasn't always been agreed upon. In the Greek society, they fought over whether the state should raise kids or the parents should raise kids. And thank God that was kind of universally decided on, that the parents should raise it, although that still seems to be up in the air in some places. But those three things, sex makes babies, society needs babies, babies need a mom and a dad. That's going to be universally true throughout the whole history of the world. And because of that, trying to navigate that, those sets of realities, sex, marriage, and babies have always been seen as a package deal. Let me give you a couple ways that we see in historically how this has always been assumed. I mean, we're here in the South. Anybody heard that phrase, shotgun wedding? This is a cultural norm in the South, right? Right? Shotgun wedding. Guy gets girl pregnant. Dad shows up at guy's house with a shotgun. By the way, this story ends differently in New York. Yeah, exactly. What's the dad want the guy to do? Now, that's different now, isn't it? Because now dad shows up at the daughter's house to keep the guy away from her. But back then, it was to marry her, and what was the phrase they used to say in the South? To do what's right by her. To do what's right. Sex, marriage, and babies are a package deal just from that norm. You can not just see it in kind of cultural norms like shotgun weddings. I'll show it. I'll give you an example in the law. So when I met Sarah, I was living in Tennessee, outside of Chattanooga. I'm in Colorado now, but I was outside of Chattanooga in Ray County, Tennessee. And I decided to go ask the woman, you know, Sarah, to marry me. She said yes, so I asked the county clerk to give us a marriage license. It was fascinating. When I asked for a marriage license, I had to do more than just fill out a form. I had to answer questions, right? And my guess is you probably did too. You might not remember it, but you had to answer questions. What questions did you have to answer? Now, remember that. I want to take us to the same-sex marriage debate. Ready? In the same-sex marriage debate, what we heard was love is love. What we heard was marriage equality. Right? What we heard was that same-sex couples can be just as deeply affectionate and sincere in their love and care for their partner as a heterosexual couple can be. Right? That was the reason we were told that we had to allow same-sex marriage, otherwise we're discriminating against people who could love the same way. All right? Now, I'm going to come back to that in just a second, but think about this. When I went, that's the way that debate went. When I went to ask for a marriage license from this woman in Ray County, Tennessee, so I could marry Sarah, she did not ask me how deeply affectionate I felt for Sarah. She did not say, "Now, are you really in love?" She did not give me an issue of Cosmo magazine with this, you know, one of those tests in there, 7 ways you know that you're really in love. If you can pass this test, I'll give you a marriage license. You know what she asked me? Number one, are you guys old enough? Because if you're not 18, then you belong to somebody else's family. Secondly, are you already married? Because if you're already married, you can't marry someone else. Number three, are you related? You knew that was coming, right? They ask you this. Why do they ask you this? Stop. After the same-sex marriage, let's go back over here. After the same-sex marriage debate, it wasn't 4 months before I saw 2 stories that we talked about on our podcast. One was of a European ethics panel that advised the European High Court that said we need to allow incestuous marriage. Why? Because by saying that brothers and sisters can't get married, we're discriminating against their deeply held affection for each other. And there was a judge in Australia who made the same case in Australia and said the reason that we said brothers and sisters can't get married, by the way, why do we say brothers and sisters can't get married? Is it because they can't fall in love? I know this is one of those times where you stop and go, we're really having this conversation. But have this conversation because we're having this conversation. Why do we say brothers and sisters shouldn't get married? It doesn't, not because they can't be in love, but what? Because it impacts the children. The Australian judge said that we've already been able to separate having babies from marriage through contraception and abortion. We can ensure that brothers and sisters don't procreate, and if they don't procreate, they should be able to get married. You go back to the questions that the Supreme Court asked, that the county clerk in Dayton, Tennessee asked me. All of them have to do with this underlying assumption that sex, marriage, and babies are a package deal. I'll give you another example of how that was always seen. I wrote a book several years ago on same-sex marriage. This is before the Obergefell decision. This is actually right around the time the Windsor decision came out. My co-author for that book was Sean McDowell, Josh McDowell's son, who's an apologist in his own right. And so we wrote this together. And people are like, why did you write a book on same-sex marriage? And I'm always like, I was hoping to make some friends. Thought that would work. One of the things that I looked at, in that book, we look at both a biblical case against same-sex marriage and the biblical case for marriage, and also a non-biblical, like, in other words, the Bible describes what happens in reality. If we leave the Bible out of it, can we still get to the same conclusion? One of the things we looked at was historically. Do you realize that throughout history that no one ever tried same-sex marriage until yesterday? I mean yesterday, you know what I mean when I say yesterday, like yesterday culturally speaking, sarcastically. Here's why. Even societies, cultures, think of some of the great empires that were thoroughly pagan. They, even the ones, get this, that did not frown upon homosexual behavior or homoerotic activity. And there was a lot of them that thought it was completely okay for a married guy to have a lover on the side who was male. But even though they tolerated and embraced, maybe even celebrated and promoted homosexuality, they did not think it was marriage. Why? Because the marital relationship has the potential for children. By the way, that actually is why I don't believe love is love. Here's why. If every single person on the planet lived in a loving, committed, godly, I mean, take out godly, we'll take out Christianity for now, a loving, committed, faithful, heterosexual relationship, would the world be a better place? Would the world have a future? Let me put it that way. Would the world have a future? If every single person on the planet lived in a loving, committed, faithful, monogamous, homosexual relationship, would the world have a future? Love isn't love unless you pretend penises and vaginas don't exist. Do you see what I mean? Now, all of this goes around. Now, I know, hopefully you see what I'm saying here. What I'm saying, I'm not trying to be crude. I'm not trying to cross any lines. What I'm trying to say is that sex, marriage, and babies have always been considered a package deal until yesterday. The sexual revolution took us on a journey of separating those things. Here's how it happened. First, we wanted to have sex without marriage. That was the initial promise that sex only after marriage is prudish. We need to get beyond that. But there's only one way you can have sex without marriage, and that is having sex without children. Babies make marriage necessary. All right? So we wanted to have sex without marriage. The only way to have sex without marriage is to have sex without babies. Then we wanted to have babies without marriage. Do you remember that conversation? Do you remember that conversation between who was it? Dan Quayle. Vice President Dan Quayle, who was running for president, and he got into a conversation with Murphy Brown, who doesn't actually exist in real life. She was a character on a sitcom. Does anybody remember this? Right? Dan Quayle says something about, well, Murphy Brown is a professional woman. She wants to do artificial insemination and have a baby without a husband. Dan Quayle says we shouldn't celebrate that. And then we got into this big fight. So we literally, it was one of the most weird moments in U.S. political history, which is saying a lot, you know, where you have a real life presidential candidate arguing with someone who doesn't exist in real life. And it probably cost him the presidency. Either that or he misspelled potato. But one of the two. 20 years, by the way, after that event, the headline of the New Yorker said, 20 years later, it turns out Dan Quayle was right all along. So we wanted to have sex without marriage. The only way to have sex without marriage is to have sex without babies. And we want to have babies without marriage. Then we want to have marriage without babies. This is why when I start with sex, marriage, and babies are separable, so many people, especially young people, look at me strangely because they have never heard from any source, including their church, that marriage and babies go together. Let me say this again. This is where it gets uncomfortable. They have never heard from any source that sex, marriage, and babies are a package deal. They've never heard it, especially that marriage and babies go together. But if you go back to the liturgies around the wedding ceremony, and I don't just mean from, you know, the high church. I don't even just mean from the Catholic Church. We know where the Catholics stand on this. And I don't even just mean the Anglicans, which go back to a prayer book from 1928. I'm talking about the old Baptist ceremonies. I'm talking about the Methodist ceremonies. If you go back there, every ceremony includes somewhere between a, you know, prayer that this marriage will be fruitful, right, to a mandate, now go have some babies. And again, I'm not talking about infertility. Let me be really clear. I'm talking about the sexual revolution has made babies optional. I'm not talking about unintentional fruitless marriages. And if you have struggled through infertility, you know how painful that is. And if you've worked with couples who struggle with infertility, you know how hard that is. It feels like something's wrong. It feels like something's missing. You know why? Because it's not the way it's supposed to be. That's the fall. So first we wanted sex without marriage. The only way to have sex without marriage is to have sex without babies. Then we want to have babies without marriage. Then we want to have marriage without babies. And now we've hit the pinnacle. We want to have babies without sex. And that's a whole new market. Especially for same-sex couples. The state of Washington just became the first state in the United States to legalize commercial surrogacy. And the reason you could legalize commercial surrogacy is so it was driven by a legislator in that state who's in a same-sex marriage who had to go overseas to get his surrogates to bear them children for couples, and he didn't want to have to travel anymore. And so now in the state of Washington, you can actually pay women beyond just expenses. It's more than a voluntary thing. It actually can become commercialized surrogacy. Now, some of us are looking at that, and I wish I had time to really dive into the ethics of that. Some of us are actually thinking, well, is that really that bad? Should commercialized surrogacy not be okay? I mean, maybe women should be paid for this. Why is that not okay? There are people maybe in this room that don't understand the ethical dilemma behind this, and I wish I had time to go into it. I've done a bunch of breakpoints on it recently, but let me just say this. If you are struggling with whether that's an ethical thing or not, this is evidence like 2.0 that the sexual revolution has changed your mind on some fundamentally really important things. the church has dramatically dropped the ball, even sometimes in talking about the taking of life. We haven't even touched the making of life. I would suggest that although I'm not Catholic for all kinds of good Protestant Reformation reasons, the Catholic understanding of the inherent connection of sexuality and procreation is worth consideration. Sex, marriage, and babies are separable. I said, remember earlier, ideas have what? Consequences. Bad ideas have victims. Let me also say this. Ideas alone don't change the world. Ideas have to become embodied. I'll give you an example. You never have the Protestant Reformation, which, by the way, is made up of ideas, the priesthood of all believers, that sort of stuff. The people should have the scripture in their own language. But it took something to make those ideas livable. What was the invention? The greatest invention in the history of the world, some people say. The iPad. No, I'm just kidding. What is it? You see what I did there? The printing press, right? The printing press was the artifact that made the ideas of the Protestant Reformation possible. There was an artifact that made the ideas of the sexual revolution possible. What do you think the artifact was, the invention, that made it possible to separate sex, marriage, and babies? The first thing is the pill. It's not the only one, but the pill is one of those. Okay? Now, and that's an interesting look too. I'm not, by the way, and I didn't want to really go too deep into these weeds. I'm not someone who thinks there's no biblical reason for contraception. I'm not Catholic in my view on this. I think Catholics, the Catholic theology of the body, for example, from John Paul and then the encyclical Humana Vitae talks about some things that are really interesting. But I'm not Catholic, and there's a reason for that, obviously, and I don't fully go down that line. But I do think that even the early Protestants that embraced contraception and the pill did not do it. They did it out of a concern for women's health. They did not do it out of a thought that it would one day make it optional for Christian couples to get married and choose not to have babies. Let me put it in a different way. Would any of you teach young couples, it's okay to have sex without marriage? Would any of you teach that? No. If sex, marriage, and babies are a package deal, are we really willing to teach it's okay to have marriage without babies intentionally? I bring this up mainly because we have not had these conversations with our young married counselors. I was going to save this to the end. Let me see what time I'm doing. When I don't have my notes, I just, oh gosh. Okay. Let me give you a punchline, because I don't want you to miss this, and I'll come back to the other two big ideas of the sexual revolution. T.S. Eliot has given me a framework that has changed my life, and I want to share that framework with you. T.S. Eliot has given me a framework to understand so many cultural conversations, and I hope this helps you as well. This is an article on education in which he says, whenever you see a new machine, two questions come to mind. Number one, what can I do with it? And number two, what is it for? And he says, which of those two questions should you start with? You guys with me? So let's imagine I come across a laptop. I've never seen a laptop before. It's not powered on. And I look to myself and I think, ooh, what can I do with this? What can I do with a laptop? Well, I can open and close it. I could have a puppet show. But that would be dramatically underutilizing the laptop, unless it was a Dell. But you know what I mean. Or let's say that it was, I almost dropped my Chick-fil-A card, man. That's like gold in a Baptist church, buddy. Woo! Or let's say that I have a laptop and it's kind of smooth and round, and I think, oh, I know what I can do with this. I could skip it across the lake. Now, can I have a puppet show and skip my laptop across the lake? Sure, but that's not what a laptop is for. So T.S. Eliot's point is before we tell people what to do with something, we need to wrestle with what is that something for. Are you with me? Okay, let's take this and apply it. Marriage. We have had about 4 decades of marriage conferences and marriage seminars on how to do marriage, what to do with your marriage, how to have a happy marriage, how to have a godly marriage, how to grow spiritually together, how to have a good sex life, how to take care of your finances. These are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful resources. My question is, have we ever taught our congregations what marriage is for? If we haven't, I wonder if we've decorated Christian morality onto a bunch of marriages that were in the process of being culturally reimagined anyway. It's the same thing when it comes to sex. We tell young people, here's what to do with sex. Don't have sex before you're married. Do this, don't do that. Have we ever told them what sex is for? Friedrich Nietzsche said, he who has the why can live with any what or how. But let me prove why I think T.S. Eliot is right. Do you remember in Matthew 19, if you've ever heard someone say, which people will often say today, Jesus never talked about homosexuality. Well, he did. He talked about sexual brokenness. And in his mind, homosexuality was known. It was understood. It wouldn't have been any question that he was referring to that too. But then you often hear, well, Jesus never talked about same-sex marriage. And the answer to that is, you're right, Jesus never talked about same-sex marriage. And that's because no one talked about same-sex marriage until about 20 years ago. So for him to talk about same-sex marriage would have been like him talking about, you know, nuclear physics. It just wouldn't have been understandable culturally. But here's what's interesting. Jesus very clearly did talk about marriage. And the framework of that conversation in Matthew 19 is so interesting because what happens is two teachers of the law go to Jesus, who's considered a teacher of the law, in a Jewish context where the whole story is what does the law say, and ask him specifically, what does the law say about divorce? Now, two things. Number one, the law is really important in this context, and they're asking a legal question. And Jesus answers a legal question in a very interesting way. But more than that, they're trying to ask Jesus, is it okay to do this with marriage? Is it okay to end marriage for any reason? Is it okay to divorce our wives? That's the question that's on the table. Jesus answers the can I do this by saying, don't you know what was true from the very what? Beginning. Isn't it interesting? First of all, in the context of the law, Jesus takes him to creation. Secondly, that in the context of asking, can I do this? Jesus answers, what is marriage for instead? In fact, if you look at what he says, what's marriage for? God made them male and female, and he made them one flesh. And if you go back to Genesis and walk through the garden where Jesus is taking you, and you say, well, what did God make men and women for? God made men and women for a very particular reason. He made woman for a very particular reason. He was trying to fix a problem. That man is... Now here's one of the... This is an example of how we miss this conversation. Please take this well. Most of the time when we look at that verse, after God creates the world and calls it good, 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 all the way through Genesis 1 and early Genesis 2, one time he says something's not good. What's not good? That man is... We often preach that as if it says that man is lonely and he needs a companion. That is absolutely not what the text says. Let me say that again. It does not say that Adam was lonely. This is not how the verse goes. It's not good that man is lonely. I will make him someone to meet his deepest emotional needs. Or it's not good that man is lonely. I will create someone to complete him. Adam is not lonely. He's hanging out with God. What does he need? I will make him someone to what? I will make him a what? A helper, a suitable helper. And if you look at Genesis chapter 2, this is what's so cool. We often teach Genesis 2 as if it's two passages, as if there's the passage of where Eve comes from and then there's the passage of naming the animals. That's not how the text goes. It's one story. Jesus is the creator, John 1, Colossians 1, but God creates Adam, and he says, it's not good that man is alone. I will make him a suitable helper. And then what happens next? God tells him to name the animals. Why does he want him to name the animals? Well, at the end of naming the animals, what does Adam say? Of all the creatures of the field, there's not a helper found that was suitable. Apparently, Adam was not just naming the animals. He was what? He was looking for a helper. And I remember reading that. I thought of the weirdest things when I was writing this book on marriage a couple years ago. I remember reading that going, well, that's not fair because animals are really helpful. All right? I mean, animals, they give us clothes, they give us labor, they give us tasty bacon. I mean, animals are so helpful. But Adam didn't need help. He needed suitable help. Help to do what? What did God tell him to do? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. The creation of Eve reflects the inherent connection of marriage and procreation. That's what the text literally says. I'm not adding anything to it. And I'm not saying companionship's not a part of marriage. You know, I didn't get married till I was 27. I shared a house with a good friend named Ted. I love Ted, but I like coming home to Sarah a lot better than coming home to Ted. Companionship's cool, but it's not what it's all about. Inherently, God gave Adam Eve to help him finish the job that he gave Adam to do on the planet. To be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. So we go back to sex, marriage, and babies being separable. Right now, it's hard to even teach that. It's hard to even communicate that. And the reason is we've talked a lot about how to do marriage, but not what marriage is for. Does that make sense? You see how all that came together? Yeah. Make sure you get the slides. Hopefully it's in a little bit more understandable order. Let me give you the second assumption of the sexual revolution, the second big idea of the sexual revolution. Ready? It's that men and women are interchangeable. So the first one is that sex, marriage, and babies are separable. The second idea is that men and women are interchangeable. Now, that idea that men and women are interchangeable has evolved. It's evolved dramatically through the 20th century. It's an idea that actually predates the sexual revolution, but the sexual revolution hijacked it. Let me tell you what I mean. The first movement of feminism, first wave feminism, was a movement about rights. The idea was women did not share an equal rights with men, and so men and women should have equal rights. They were being left out of some parts of society, like voting and things like that. And I'm talking, by the way, most of the early feminists were pro-life even. That's what's really interesting as well. All I'm saying is I think it had some helpful correctives, and it was correcting some problems that existed in society, that men and women, and here's the first chapter, men and women are interchangeable in rights. They should have, as human beings made in the image of God, equal rights. Somewhere during the sexual revolution, second wave feminism was hijacked. And second wave feminism went to a whole different level. And it went from men and women are interchangeable in rights to men and women are interchangeable in roles. That in social roles, they should be interchangeable. Now, that was a mixed bag because there were some roles that women were being left out of that there's no reason they should be left out of. But there are other roles that actually reflect God's design of what men and women are and how they're different and what men are for and what women are for and how that's different. And so the second wave feminism actually got that confused. Does that make sense? Okay. Now we've hit a whole nother chapter. This is a whole nother level beyond that. So first wave feminism, men and women are interchangeable in rights. I'm thumbs up on that one. Men and women are interchangeable in roles. I'm, yes, sideways on that one. The third one, though, which we've hit is this. Men and women are interchangeable in reality. So when we talk about the culture having gone an anthropological shift, let me tell you what I mean. The single newest word I know of is the word cisgender. A year ago, I talked about cisgender to an audience like this, and no one in the room, or maybe a year and a half ago, no one in the room knew what it was. By now, it's more of a part of our vocabulary. How many of you guys have at least heard that word, cisgender? How many of you guys never heard that word until now? Okay, so most of you have. So it's interesting, just in the last year. Cisgender is defined this way. Cisgender refers, ready, to anyone who continues to identify with the sex that they were assigned at birth. Should I say that again? Cisgender refers to someone who continues to identify with the sex that they were assigned at birth. Now, this is a loaded definition. First of all, who would fit into that category of cisgender then? Most people throughout the history of the world. And what I mean by that is the vast majority of people. A generation ago, it would have been, well, that's just what we mean by normal. But the problem with calling that normal means anything that's not cisgender is abnormal. And so if you have a word for transgender, you have to have a word for cisgender. Does that make sense? That's the first thing that took place. So now, basically, having your sex, biological sex, and your gender align is a category of person. It's not the norm. It's just one of two options. Or not two options, but more options. The second thing in that definition is something else that's changed. Because we used to say that sex is biological and gender is a social construct. So sex is whether you have this genitalia or that genitalia. Gender is whether you would choose to identify with it or not. But that means that there's something about male and female that's fixed. And that has to go in the new sexual ideology. If we really mean that men and women are interchangeable, then our genitalia, there's no such thing as male genitalia and female genitalia. So now, did you hear the definition of cisgender? Those who continue to define or identify with the sex that they were assigned at birth. Sex is not recognized. Sex is what? So really, there's a sense now in this new gender ideology that there's an injustice done at the hospital because the doctor says it's a boy based on genitalia. And some women might have penises, and some men might have vaginas. The Women's March a couple years ago had the hats. Do you remember the hats? And the transgender community got very, very angry at the Women's March. Because are you saying that all women have those parts? Last week. In fact, this is my breakpoint today. If you listen to Breakpoint today, it's about Martina Navratilova. Martina Navratilova, probably the second greatest tennis player ever, was the greatest before Serena, but Serena is Serena, and that's it. Martina Navratilova was a hero of the gay community. She came out as lesbian in 1981, but that seems really early, so maybe it was 1991. She got in a lot of trouble. She was just kicked off an LGBT advocacy group. Because she suggested that biological men should not compete against women in sports. And because of that, she was called a trans-exclusionary feminist. So she's anti-trans. This is one of the interesting things when you start saying men and women are interchangeable. There is a brewing war between the L and the T in the acronym right now. I say that as something to look for in culture, as someone trying to minister the gospel, and also something to take advantage of. There are ideas sometimes you can just, the five scariest words in the Bible, anybody know what the five scariest words in the Bible are? And God turned them over. God's judgment is rarely sending a calamity. God's judgment most of the time is letting gravity work. And this is one of the things I think we're seeing is that the L and the T are in real conflict because the L is based on really a feminist idea that I'm a woman and a man cannot understand my experience, and that includes when it comes to sexuality. The T is saying a man can appropriate a female experience. And now we're really getting to the point where this is really interfering with some really big parts of society. I got to be honest, I thought there'd be enough dads of 9-year-old girls who would rise up in the age of youth soccer and stop this whole nonsense, but apparently there wasn't. College of Charleston, just down the road, the professor there, he's a transgender, identifies as a woman, just won the world champion cycling championship for the age bracket that he's in as a woman. And you look at the winner's photo, and everybody has spandex because they're riding bikes, so you're really clear, right? I mean, it makes sense. and you've got a woman and a woman, and then you've got a guy that's built like a box in the middle that's about 5 inches taller and about 100 pounds heavier. And here's what he said. He said, it doesn't matter if it's fair or not. This is about transgender rights. So this is kind of the men and women are interchangeable on the right. But see, here's one of the problems. As the church, let me go back to the T.S. Eliot model, okay? As the church, what we have taught for a generation is male and female, men and women's roles. Roles are at least at some level culturally contingent. I think there are some roles that so reflect God's design that they stay solid as culture changes, but not all of them. But here's where we've missed it. When we talk about roles, if that's all we talk about, when we talk about roles, let me say this carefully, we're talking about what men and women can do. Before we decide what men and women can do, we need to answer the question, what are men and women for? This is why I think T.S. Eliot solved our problem and he's dead. When it comes to sex, when it comes to marriage, when it comes to gender, before we say do this, don't do this, moral, 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 the shift that we've undergone as a society has not been a moral one, it's been an anthropological one. T.S. Eliot wants to take us back to anthropology before we talk morality, and I think that's a very helpful way of unlocking the biblical story. All right, that's the second idea of the sexual revolution. Ready? Here's the third. And this is really where it gets tragic and where we start seeing these culture-wide aftershocks. So the first one is that sex, marriage, and babies are separable. The second one is that men and women are interchangeable. The third one is that human dignity is synonymous with sexual autonomy. Let me say this again. Human dignity is synonymous with sexual autonomy. Human dignity is not a concept that exists throughout the history of the world. Human dignity is an innovation. What I mean by that, in most societies throughout the history of the world, it was assumed that some people were better than others. It was assumed that some people had rights and others did not. It was assumed that some were citizens and others were slaves. And that's changed. It's changed based on skin color. It's changed based on dominant society. It's changed based on whether you were male or female, whether you were a child or an adult, all of that, whether you were slave or free, all of that. And that's one of the most revolutionary things, right? When Paul jumps into Corinthians and he says there's neither slave nor free. In fact, later on, Friedrich Nietzsche will say that it was that sort of thinking from the Apostle Paul that was built on something fundamentally true about what it means to be human that gave human dignity to the world. Nietzsche says that human dignity as a concept owes its existence to Christianity. Because what Christianity brings in is this idea that human beings all are made in the image of God. Let me put this a different way. Remember our founding documents? We hold these truths to be that all are created equal. Now, listen, that's something that our country said and didn't live up to for a really long time. Fair enough? But it was an idea that exceeded our reality. It was an idea that America ended up striving for. Some people would say it was an idea that made the Civil War inevitable. Now, all that to say, I just want to look at that idea that all men are created equal, that it's self-evident. Is it self-evident that we're all equal? I mean, seriously, look around. Look around. Is it self-evident that we're equal? Look again. No. When you look around, it's not evident that we're equal. It's actually evident that we're what? That's the first thing we see. We're difference in age, difference in size, difference in gender, difference in strength and intelligence and skin color. You know, you can just kind of go down the line. So if there is an equality, it can't be based on anything on the outside. It can only be based on something that we all share on the inside, and Christianity is the only source for that. By the way, a bunch of atheists have written about this. Most recently, a University of Paris philosopher named Luc Ferry, who says that the image of God, the idea of the image of God, is the single thing to which the world owes its democratic inheritance. That's an atheist that says that. It's profound. Now you say, what's all this got to do with anything? Follow the history. Image of God. Christianity starts suggesting that there's no differences between slave or free, Greek and Roman. There's no slave between Hebrew and male and female. And then you have this idea of human equality, this idea of human dignity. And this starts embedding itself in democratic experiences. It's hardly ever lived out fully well, but it's there. And this is what we have. We like human dignity. We like to say that everyone has rights. We like that sort of thing. But we no longer like the Christianity that actually gave it to us. We no longer like the Christian morality that comes along with the Christianity that gave it to us. So what do we want to do? We want to keep human dignity, but untether it from the source. So what the sexual revolution had to do was appropriate. Talk about cultural appropriation. The sexual revolution appropriated the idea of human dignity and tethered it to sexual autonomy. The sexual revolution wanted to take captive human dignity, keep human dignity, untether it from Christianity, and instead what they tethered it to was sexual autonomy, the ability to decide for oneself one's sexual future. And it used to be just sexual behavior. Now it's sexual identity and everything in between. And that's why. When somebody says, I'm transgender, you might have a kid or a grandkid like this, and what they say to you is, you don't love me unless you affirm me. They don't say I disagree, because you're talking morality. They're talking identity. By the way, that should be one big red flag on how we should talk to sexual minorities, those who are confused about who they are and their behavior, is that if we treat them as if the single most important thing about them is their sexual choices, as opposed to that they're made in the image of God, we're reinforcing the lie. Just like when you go minister to someone in a prison. See, that's the thing. The sexual revolution has taken a whole generation prison in their minds, in their hearts. But is the single most important thing about that person you're ministering to behind bars that they're incarcerated? Or is the single most important thing about them is that God loves them because they're made in the image and likeness of God? Now, it doesn't mean you ever go, hey, yeah, stealing, that wasn't that bad, and you shouldn't be in jail. But it goes back to anthropology, not just morality. Just one other quick thing, two other quick things, and I'll be done. Number one, as I said earlier, ideas have consequences, bad ideas have victims. It's in this third category, sexual autonomy, that we find all the victims of the sexual revolution. Because consistently, the individuals that got in the way of sexual autonomy have been children. So with abortion, so that we can have sexual freedom, in abortion we tell ourselves they're not really kids. Now science tells us they're kids. In fact, just last week, how many of you guys watched the debate between Mike Adams and Willie Parker that was at UNCW, UNC Wilmington? How many of you guys watched that? One person. Did you guys even know that was taking place? Willie Parker calls himself a Christian abortionist. Mike Adams is a professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and a believer, writes for Town Hall and other things. And they debated at UNC Wilmington just last week. You can see the YouTube video. You know what Willie Parker now says? He says, yes, abortion takes the lives of human beings. You know what they used to say? They don't say that anymore, right? So that's the first group, first time we saw children victimized by that. The second way is in no-fault divorce. No-fault divorce severed the tie between marriage and children. And no-fault, remember the lie about no-fault divorce? The kids will be what? The kids will be fine. Kids need happy parents, not married parents. Remember that? Guess what? All that turned to be false. All the studies are in. Kids needed married parents, even if you're not happy. So that's another victim. And then we heard this when it comes to same-sex marriage. Kids don't need a mom and a dad. Kids just need loving parents. By the way, all the research we have tells us that kids that grow up with married mom and dad do better, and that moms and dads parent differently. I know, this is, I know, do you realize, like, there's research about how moms and dads, did you know moms and dads parent differently? I used to live in Tennessee, and this old boy at my church used to go, man, it ain't rocket surgery, you know, and and you're welcome. You will all use that now, won't you? Isn't that classic? Isn't that great? And this is it. But there's research about this. But now same-sex marriage says, oh, well, kids don't need a mom and a dad. They just need loving parents. No research says that. Research says kids need mom and dad, and moms and dads, moms can't dad and dads can't mom. Now we have another generation of victims to sexual autonomy, which is we have a country that has chosen an intentionally sterile union, and now some of those who have taken part in that intentionally sterile union are demanding children. Right? So what drove the Seattle law is called the Universal Parentage Act, which is everyone has a right to have to be parents. So we went from the inherent connection of sex and marriage and babies to severing it to now basically saying it's something I want. If I want it, then I should have a right to it. Does that make sense? It's not an inherent connection. It's not a blessing, as the scripture would say. It's a right that I can claim. And so now kids can be made with three parents, you know, through embryonic technology, they can be made in all those sorts of ways. This is another way that those kids will be fine. We've created a whole generation of kids outside the womb in labs, and we have no idea what their experience is going to be. And some of them are really struggling. Some of them have survivor guilt because they were the embryo that survived, and the others created by IVF weren't. The last way now, of course, we're saying that the kids will be fine is basically allowing kids who struggle with their identity to have puberty blockers and, you know, medical intervention in their process of growing up, even though 80% of kids who struggle with gender dysphoria grow out of it sometime in their teenage years. But again, our sexual autonomy is leading now. It's become the new definition of dignity, and that's why the victims have always been kids. Now, look, I know I kind of gave you kind of this. Some of you are like, so what's the good news, right, after that? Let me just say one quick thing. The good news is that we have the single best answer to the question, what does it mean to be human, on the market of worldviews. Do you realize that the image of God is such a rich theological concept? Please don't neglect it. If I go from church to church to church and I said, hey, everybody fill in the blank, humans are made, and everyone would say together, in the image of God. And you say, well, what is the image of God? How do we know what the image of God is? How does it make us different than the animals? Most people would not be able to answer it. Here it is. If your people in your churches do not know what the image of God is, they don't know who they are. If they don't know who they are, they will not be able to navigate the anthropological challenges of our culture. The image of God can no longer be trivia. The image of God has to be a theological grounding for people in this generation. Prioritize the teaching of the image of God. Listen to T.S. Eliot. Before we tell people how to behave, tell them what they're for. And once you get those things clear, then the questions like in vitro fertilization in your church, what do our couples in our church need to follow Jesus? And if they do happen to struggle with infertility, or if they do have the opportunities for adoption, or if they do struggle with an unplanned pregnancy, how do we help them walk through these challenges? You can't do that if they don't have that theological grounding. Does that make sense? Now, I know some of you are like, but how do I help the transgender kid here? How do I help the kid who just announced he was gay here? What about the kid in my youth group now who's going after our church on Facebook because he says we don't love him anymore? How do I deal with all of that sort of stuff? I hate to say this. Buy my book. In the book, there's a whole lot of other resources that we point to, specifically on the L, the G, the B, the T. Right now, I got to say, though, the resources on the T are dreadfully inadequate. There's a really good book by Andrew Walker called God and the Transgender Debate. And that would be the place I would tell you to start if you're dealing with the T. Thank you, guys.